I trust that all of you have seen the brochure for the ETS regional meetings here today, this afternoon and evening. Some well-known people are going to be mingling here, and they've got some awfully interesting topics. This afternoon, beginning at 1:25, there are 5 parallel sessions. And, boy, some of the topics are fascinating. People are coming from Capital Bible Seminary, from Liberty University, from Chesapeake Theological Seminary, from Westminster Theological Seminary, Philadelphia College of Bible, from CBN University, from Valley Forge Christian College, various places, and giving papers of, some of them sound really fascinating. So if you haven't seen the schedule on the board, take a look. And, well, what happens is the sessions start at 1:25 and run through 5:15. Well, there's a little business session, but that concerns members. And then at 7, there's a plenary session. Norman Geisler is going to be speaking on the empty tomb, dematerialization, or resurrection. So if you've never heard Geisler, this is an opportunity. If you've made plans otherwise, of course, you can't do it. You know, you can't be everywhere at once. But it's awfully interesting schedule. I have suggested that Romans 1 through 8 be divided into three basic emphases. First, condemnation. Second, justification. Third, sanctification. The first major stress, the first major section, I've entitled God's Condemnation of All Human Beings for Their Unrighteousness, 1:18 through 3:20. And I've suggested two major strands of thought that Paul develops in this first section. First, man's unrighteousness. Second, God's righteous judgment. So if you were using Roman numeral 1 as a heading for notes, the first major strand, man's unrighteousness, would be capital A. And then we're looking at two lines of evidence to establish man's unrighteousness. And the first one would be Arabic 1. All unregenerate human beings are opposers of the truth of God. We looked at that last time. And then Arabic 2, all unregenerate human beings are transgressors of the law of God. That's where we begin today. The second line of evidence to establish man's unrighteousness. What is the law of God? The law of God is the revelation of the righteous will of God addressed to man's obedience. The revelation of the righteous will of God addressed to man's obedience. Instead of giving hearty obedience to God's righteous law, we discover that human beings turn to various forms of unrighteousness. And they practice them, even though they know that their sin is wrong and that a life of unrighteousness justly deserves divine retribution. The law of God reveals God's perfect standard of righteousness, which in turn reflects God's attribute or quality or characteristic of righteousness. The law reveals God's perfect standard of righteousness, which in turn reveals God's perfect attribute of righteousness. Whenever God's standard of righteousness confronts fallen human beings, it reveals sin. Romans 3:20 tells us that by the law is the knowledge of sin. Now, initially, you think of that simply in terms of cognitive knowledge. That is, you learn what sin is by the law. The law tells you what sin is. Later on in the epistle, we discover that Paul stretches that concept. It's not just that the law gives us cognitive knowledge, but the law, in a sense, gives us experiential knowledge, that is, by addressing us, and we then discovering that the law stirs up sin in us, innate sin in us. So the law gives us not only a cognitive, but an experiential knowledge of sin. It's very interesting. Sin in ourselves, that is. What is sin? 1 John 3:4 tells us that whosoever commits sin transgresses also the law, for sin is the transgression of the law. 1 John 3:4. Bill.
What about experiential relationship of law and sin?
Yes. Could I hold on that when we get to Romans 7? Okay? Thanks. Then we'll expand that. In Romans 3:23 is a verse which many people have memorized. We're told that all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Now, that's one of those verses that we memorize, but we don't think about in terms of what it means. When we start to reflect upon Romans 3:23, a curious thing opens up to us. There are two parts. It says, all have sinned. That's fairly straightforward. But the second part says, and present tense come short of the glory of God. Now, the way it's phrased in English, you're not sure that it's a present tense. You don't know that. But the first part says, all have sinned, and the second part says, all do come short of the glory of God, a present tense. Now, the way I read it for years, all have sinned and all have come short of the glory of God. That's the way I read it. I took it in that way. What does it mean to fall short or to come short of the glory of God? It cannot mean simply that we all fall short of the splendor of God's magnificence. It cannot simply mean that. For that would simply mean that we're all finite. That's all that would mean. There's nothing culpable in being finite. There's nothing blameworthy in being finite. Adam and Eve were created finite. Before the fall, they weren't culpable or blameworthy for being finite. It says, all come short of the glory of God. So you have to ask, what is glory? One time I was visiting a church down in Virginia, and the preacher used the word glory. Oh, I stopped counting at a certain point. He must have said it 50 times in his sermon. But never did he define it. And I sat there, my mind boggled, you know. He used the word glory, but I didn't know what glory meant. What was glory? You know, if you say it the right way, it elicits an emotional response. You lift off the chair a little bit. But what does it mean, you know? What does it mean? The glory of God, the splendor of God's magnificence, the high exalted quality of his characteristics, his attributes. But that really can't be what is being said here. There must be more than that. The glory of God here, I would suggest, means the expression of God's magnificent nature, but then not just the expression of God's magnificent nature in toto. But I would suggest in this context, since we're talking about sin, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, and this appears to be culpable here, we're in a moral issue here, I would suggest that it's more specific than just all fall short of the expression of the magnificence of the totality of God's attributes. I would suggest that what Paul is getting at here is God's glorious attribute of righteousness. Now that's one of God's attributes. All have sinned and all fall short of the glorious attribute of righteousness. Why righteousness? Because this falling short is related to sin. And I would suggest that this glorious attribute of righteousness is reflected in his perfect standard of righteousness. This perfect attribute of righteousness is reflected in his perfect standard of righteousness, his law. And I would suggest, therefore, that the verse means that all human beings have sinned, that is, have transgressed the law of God, since sin is transgression of law. All human beings have sinned, that is, have transgressed the law of God, and continue to sin, present tense, that is, fall short of God's standard of righteousness, which reflects God's glorious attribute of righteousness. And this is set up on this overhead that you have. I would suggest that what you've got going here is the glory of God, his essential nature, that's the magnificence, the splendor of the sum total of God's attributes, and as they are expressed. And then the revelation of the glory of God in his attribute of righteousness, not ruling out his revelation in other attributes, but just singling out this one because of the context. And then the reflection of the glory of God, that is, the attribute of righteousness, in his law of righteousness. And I would suggest all have sinned and all continue to sin. Bill.
By law, do you mean, are we to understand the moral law of
Haven't specified that yet. No. By the law of God, I mean the revelation of the righteous will of God addressed to man's obedience. Now, I'll try to provide another definition a little farther on. The revelation of the righteous will of God addressed to man's obedience. See, I have to say it that way because will is such a broad term. Will can mean decree, it can mean desire, it can mean purpose, it can mean intention, it can mean commands or precepts. It can mean a lot of different things. So I suggest the revelation of the righteous will of God addressed to man's obedience. So we're talking about what sometimes is called the preceptive will of God or the commanding will of God. And I would suggest this as the understanding of Romans 3:23. For all have sinned and all continue to sin. Shorthand. Okay? All have sinned, all continue to sin. But with this scenario of what it means when Paul is talking about the glory of God. Again, it can't be just that we all fall short of God's glory in terms of finiteness. Can't be that. So you've got to unpack it further and say, hey, what's going on here? Paul provides a good deal of evidence in this second line of evidence to show that unsaved human beings are unrighteous. He provides quite a bit of evidence here. He does this by pointing out various ways in which human beings transgress the law of God, especially by violating the Ten Commandments. By the way, it's very interesting. Whenever Paul starts to catalog various sins, it's interesting from time to time to watch how he adverts to the Ten Commandments. He doesn't always make reference to the Ten Commandments. He doesn't always make reference to sins, a catalog of sins, in just the kinds of terms that you would immediately think, Ten Commandments. But sometimes the way he goes through the list, he goes right down the Ten Commandments in terms of what they say. It's very interesting. Now, you have a two-page handout here in with the overhead material entitled Man's Unrighteousness as Revealed by the Righteous Law of God, summarized in the Ten Commandments as developed by Paul in Romans 1:18-3:20. You should have that. I hope you're bringing your notes with you to class. I mean, well, I've listed the Ten Commandments here. And you notice how in this section, 118 to 320, how Paul makes reference to various aspects of the Decalogue. You can just run your eye down that. The first commandment and references to that. The second commandment. The third commandment. God's name. There's no specific reference to the fourth commandment, the Sabbath. That could be partly because it's a veiled reference to the ceremonial aspect of the law, or because of the audience to whom Paul is writing. It may have something to do with that. Although you have a mixture in the Church of Rome, Jews and Gentiles, it may be that he's not stressing that which might be considered ceremonial. The fifth commandment, notice references to that. The sixth commandment. The seventh commandment. The eighth commandment. The ninth commandment. And the tenth commandment. And then speaks of mankind in general and says, become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, and depravity. Speaking of the Jews, you who brag about the law, do you dishonor God by breaking the law? And Jews and Gentiles? Now that's all very straightforward. Evidence showing man's unrighteousness. But of course you think, well, that's okay for those who have the Ten Commandments. For those who have the law, the Mosaic law, and especially this great summarization of what we frequently refer to as moral law in the Ten Commandments. But what about the human beings who do not have the Ten Commandments, who do not possess the revealed law of God? Are they unrighteous? See, Paul is attempting to establish man's unrighteousness. That's the second line of evidence here. The question is, how are you going to establish man's unrighteousness with those who do not have the revealed law of God? And if so, if they are unrighteous, by what standard are they unrighteous? Yes, Jack.
Are you saying that Paul set out to show how man is not needy with the nails? And that's why we find him each.
He's attempting to show that man is unrighteous.
But did he set out when they read the commandments and said, okay?
Well, there are all these references to the commandments in this section. You have to draw your own conclusion. Paul takes up these questions of how to establish unrighteousness among those who do not have a revealed law. Here he identifies the standard by which the Gentiles are shown to be unrighteous. In Romans 2:14 and 15, he says, when the Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature the things of the law, these not having the law are a law to themselves, who show the law's work written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts alternatively accusing or even defending them. Now, interestingly enough, I think he uses the word law in three different senses in these two verses. The first one seems fairly obvious. We're talking about Mosaic law. When the Gentiles who do not have the law, the Mosaic law. When they do, because in the context, if you look at the context, he's talking about contrast between Jews and Gentiles and so forth. When they do by nature, physis, by nature, the nature of anything is what it is. And when you do something by nature, you do it from what you are. When they do by nature the things of the law, and again, I would suggest the Mosaic law. They don't have the Mosaic law, but yet they do the things of the Mosaic law. That suggests that the Gentiles, even though they don't have the Mosaic law, that they do some actions which are at least in external conformity to the law, the Mosaic law. And when they do that, these not having the Mosaic law are a law, and I would suggest there for that the idea of a moral standard, a standard of morality. They are a law to themselves. In a sense, they are law personified or law embodied, a standard of morality. In what sense? They show the law. Now here, you notice I capitalize that simply because there aren't three ways of doing it. Capital L, small l, and something else. I don't know what the something else would be. Greek? I don't know. Anyway, I capitalized it because here I think Paul is talking not about the Mosaic law specifically, or, if I may make that more particular, not about the Mosaic codification of the law of God. But I suggest that this use, who show the law that this is the law of God, who show the law's work written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts alternatively accusing or even defending them. See, it can't be the Mosaic law, because they don't have the Mosaic law. It can't be the work of the Mosaic law written in their hearts. It can't be that, because they don't have the Mosaic law. So I suggest this is the law of God, and that above, in those other uses of law, that refers more specifically to the Mosaic codification of the law of God. Now, we will need to talk about that further, especially in Romans 7. Well, I would suggest that this is the standard on which the Gentiles are shown to be unrighteous. Now, obviously, we've got to do something further with that. Quick question.
Is there a difference between the Mosaic law and the law of God?
I would say so, but what the differences are need to be explored. Yes. Okay. Paul summarizes his evidence concerning man's unrighteousness in chapter 3, verses 9 and 10 and 12. Chapter 3, 9 and 10 and 12. What then? Are we better than they? Now, you don't know right offhand who the we are and who the they are. Okay? But he's been talking about the Jews in chapter 2, and he starts out in chapter 3, what advantage has the Jew, etc., etc. Are we better than they? Whatever you take, Jews better than the Gentiles or Gentiles better than the Jews, it doesn't seem to matter here, okay? You can fiddle with that exegetically, but it doesn't seem to matter. Because he says, not at all, for we have already charged that both Jews and Greeks are all under sin. He seems to use Greeks here interchangeably with Gentiles. They're all under sin. As it is written, there is none righteous, not even one. That's awfully strong. It's a quotation, of course, from the Old Testament. And he quotes it and affirms it. Verse 12, all have turned aside, together they have become useless. There is none who does good, there is not even one. Now that seems to conflict a little with Romans 2, 14 and 15, when Gentiles who don't have the Mosaic law do, by nature, from their nature, the things in the Mosaic law. That suggests that they do some things that are at least in external conformity to the Mosaic law. And you'd almost have to say, hey, aren't those good things? I mean, if they're in conformity to the Mosaic law, and the Mosaic law is a law of righteousness, then aren't they doing good things? Yes, they're doing relatively good things. They're doing relatively good things. But Paul says here, there's none who does good, there is not even one. And he quotes that and affirms it. So the problem is how to put together this doing of the law in terms of external conformity to it, and this doing good here in chapter 3 and verse 12. And the exclusion of everybody, says there's none who does good, not even one. Of course, you have to bracket that. You understand this does not exclude the Lord Jesus Christ. You understand that. There is none who does good, there's not even one. He's not excluding the Lord Jesus Christ, including the Lord Jesus Christ in that condemnation. So you have to ask, what is the meaning then of Romans 2, 14 and 15? What does it mean to do some things in external conformity to the Mosaic Law? Some of the things, in other words, that the Mosaic Law commands, or some of the things it forbids. And if you're in external conformity, does that mean you're doing something good, you know, in some way? And here he says, no, not even one, nothing good, none who does good. Well, it may be that you can't avoid getting into motivation here. It may be that you can't avoid it. So you finally come down to that, and you've got to ask, out of what motivation do the Gentiles who do some things in external conformity to the Mosaic Law, out of what motivation do they do them? But that's a whole trip, you know, that's a whole journey to take that one and travel through a thicket, a mass of all sorts of information in ethics, and try to get at what the motivation, what part it plays in good acts. In any case, for the moment, we'll recognize that as far as Paul's purpose is concerned, there is no one who does good, and we'll have to take that for the moment in the sense of the law of God. Remember, the law of God is not the law of Moses or the law of man per se. It's the law of God. Now, God requires absolute perfection. God requires absolute conformity. So that if you're talking about good in the sense of righteousness, in the sense of conformity to the law of God in its intention as the law of God, then it requires perfect obedience. And that requires perfect motivation. So if you take it that way, then good in verse 12, none who does good, has to be taken in the sense of perfect obedience to the will of God as it is addressed to man's obedience. Then, obviously, you've got something else going on in 2, 14, and 15. You've got to say some qualifiers, external conformity, some sort of outward agreement, something like that, in order to make that distinction. Well, Paul has brought us to a rather difficult spot, quite frankly. He has brought us to the place where he has shown that human beings are opposers of the truth of God and rebels against the law of God, transgressors of the law of God. So the next question is, what's he going to do with that? Where are we going to go with that? And that will bring us, Lord willing, next time to this second part, God's righteous judgment, the second strand under this first section.